Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Seth Hall filling in for Alan Cardoza. I'm welcoming Mrs. Lisa Boucher to the show this morning. Lisa, can you hear me?
I can hear you, and it's Boucher, if I may correct you.
You may. Boucher.
Boucher, like Bobby Boucher, the water boy.
That's right. I thought it might be that way, but I went ahead and hacked it anyways.
It's a tough one.
Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Looking so forward to talking about your book this morning and all of the wonderful work you guys are doing.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Very good. So, Lisa, for the past 28 years, Lisa has worked with hundreds of women to overcome alcoholism, live better lives, and become better parents. She was prompted to write Raising the Bottom when, after 24 years of working in hospitals, she realized that doctors in traditional healthcare offer few solutions to women with addiction issues. She is dedicated not only to help women recover from alcoholism, but has extended her reach to educate and help corporations deal with the growing addiction problem that has permeated every sphere of American life. An author of 5 books, she holds a BA in English and is the mother of twin sons. She currently resides in Ohio with her husband. Raising the Bottom is her 5th book. She was prompted to write Raising the Bottom when she realized, after 20-plus years of working in hospitals, that doctors and traditional healthcare offer few solutions to women with addiction issues. Raising the Bottom was a proud finalist in the 2017 USA Best Book Award. Her other books include Jesus, Moe and the Cheese Puffs, Black Butterflies, and White Fences. Welcome, Lisa.
Thank you so much, Seth. Happy to be here.
Very good. So I see you've written 5 books.
Well, yes, I have. I mean, you only mentioned 3 because the other one, I've got one that's still in the computer. The other one was so many years ago, it's out there in the world somewhere, Imperfect Souls. But I wrote fiction for years. And then I switched over Raising the Bottom to nonfiction when, I realized that we have just such a huge addiction problem in America. I'm in recovery, 30 years sober. And raised as my mom was alcoholic. So I have like a 360 view of this disease. And like you mentioned, working, I work in healthcare. So I'm seeing a lot of things, and I'm seeing a lot of things that are not working. And I'm seeing a lot of people that their lives continue to get worse and worse. And in so many cases, they come to the hospital for a plethora of reasons. But underlying all of this malaise and depression and anxiety and diseases, kidney, heart, cancers, et cetera, is substance abuse, alcoholism, alcohol misuse. I mean, there's a lot of functional alcoholics in the world. People, maybe they're not full-blown alcoholic, but they're certainly misusing alcohol because they're daily drinkers and they're just kind of existing through life, kind of sleepwalking through life. So those were the people I focused on in Raising the Bottom, because I think there's such a huge stigma still, Seth, with everybody thinking if you're not on the 6 o'clock news and crashing cars or wearing a trench coat, that you're not an alcoholic.
Right.
And that's just not true. So.
Right. Amazing. I love that your book is specific to women. I had the opportunity to read the introduction and get into the first couple chapters. And I love that it was, you kind of were looking at it through the viewpoint of the children of the alcoholic in the book.
Well, you know, Seth, I feel like, and this is just the truth. Like I said, my background, being a child of an alcoholic, the focus was trying to get my mother some help because she was misdiagnosed for 25 years, which is a travesty in and of itself, and not much has changed in healthcare. But there is very little attention on the children. And even with the opioid epidemic and all of the what's going on, these kids are traumatized. I was traumatized. We're going to have a whole generation of children that are going into foster care, and they are not getting the care and the love and the attention and the guidance they need in these foster homes. That's another separate issue. We need better services. I mean, housing a child and feeding them is not raising a child. So for anybody who has children, I don't know if you do or not,
I do, yes.
But it takes a lot more than that to bring about a human being that can function and be a productive member of society. So I saw where these kids are just, they're falling through the cracks. It's heartbreaking. And I don't know. I mean, I feel like I was lucky to make it to where I am because I had very little guidance as a child. My siblings either, with the way our family dynamics were. And, you know, I came from, my mother was a registered nurse. My father was a businessman. So it looked very normal and stable from the outside, but there was not a lot of guidance. There was, we were traumatized by my mother's alcoholism, the car crashes, the, her falling all over the floor, not waking up, appearing to be almost overdosing because doctors had her on benzos like Valium. My father was a rageaholic. So we had really no guidance. And there's many, many children like that today. And many of them are in affluent homes. So I want to point that out because I see a lot of that where families, because they have titles and make a lot of money and they live in these nice homes. And I know these children are suffering. And in fact, there were many when I was raising my sons where several families that I knew, it was just a house of cards with their own addiction that was going on. And I remember like telling my husband and my son, these kids are all going to be in trouble. And I've been right. I mean, it's uncanny the way I can peg it so early, but I think I've been like steeped in addiction like a tea bag since I've been a kid. I can recognize it in kids as young as 7 years old. You can see the traits. If you couple that with looking at the family dynamics and what's going on, you can almost accurately predict who is going to have addiction issues if intervention doesn't happen soon. And so I wanted to give the kids a voice. I did a whole chapter to what your kids say about you and your drinking. And I know some people are very uncomfortable with that, but that there should tell you all you need to know about your relationship with alcohol. Because these children, I have two letters in the book, and they are daughters of physicians. And these were women physicians that are both still working, and they're both now in recovery. But during the time they were in their full-blown addiction, they were still working in the hospital. They were coming home, and they were using drugs and or alcohol until they went to bed, only to get up and do it all over again. And their kids, though they looked well cared for, their children were suffering because you can't be present in a child's life, in a spouse's life, in anyone's life, when you're constantly preoccupied with, when am I going to get off work to drink? Do I have what I need at home? What store do I need to go to? What party? What wine tasting? I mean, when this is your life and your focus, you're not really there for the people that need you emotionally, if that makes sense.
It absolutely makes sense. And I think that you really give it some perspective, being that you yourself came from this kind of family dynamic. And it sort of is miraculous that because you were really a prime candidate to have this go off the rails, it could have gone off the rails for you, but I love that how you mentioned that if an intervention doesn't happen, then, you know, it can turn into something really ugly, right?
Well, yeah, I think we really, you know, like I said, I was working for a while with children in a psych facility. And so many of these kids, there's really nothing wrong with them other than crappy parenting that has to do in 90% of the cases with the parents' substance abuse. So they have environments very similar to what I grew up. And, you know, I'm very grateful back in the day that really wasn't an option to go run your kid to the psychiatrist. And like I said, my family, my mom was too dysfunctional in her own addiction to really think of that. So she didn't know if we were depressed or how we were doing or really anything. But I'm very grateful that I wasn't put on medication, because who knows if I would be where I am. So, you know, and then when my addiction started, I mean, I did fall into it, because what else are you going to do? I mean, I had my first beer at 12 years old.
Right.
But I was able to, by, I don't know, God's grace, and I think my mother, because God bless her, when she finally, she had an accident, broke her neck, fell down the steps at home and broke her neck. And that's what finally landed her in rehab with a physician who understood that my mother was an alcoholic. And it was the first doctor, therapist, or psychiatrist, or any person in the medical profession in 25 years who told my mother, there's nothing wrong with you other than you're an alcoholic. Yeah. She had been misdiagnosed as manic depressive, bipolar. She was on these horrible psych drugs like lithium and Thorazine, which, I mean, those are fine for people if you're a schizophrenic or if you really are bipolar.
Right.
But when they give those kinds of medications to people that don't really need them, my mother just could not function. She was like a zombie. And it was tragic to see this vibrant, beautiful, very smart. My mother was wickedly smart. One of the best diagnosticians I've ever seen in my life. She could diagnose better than just about any physician ever. And so here she was, just, you know, not able to function. So thank God this woman saw her for what she was. She went to rehab. And then by the time my drinking was escalating, my mother had 7 years sober. So she started to chirp in my ear that, you know, hey, Lisa, your drinking is starting to not look so social. And, you know, I decided to listen. That's the miraculous part, because very few people quit drinking at the point where I was in my life. I mean, I was newly married. I was 4 years married at the time. My husband's a professional. We were having a lot of fun. We didn't have our children yet. Nobody quits drinking at that point.
Right.
But emotionally, I was really having a hard time keeping it together. I couldn't really predict, am I going to be laughing or crying? Am I going to be raging or depressed? What was Lisa going to do today, or how is she going to feel today? So that was starting to bother me, that I had this unpredictable lability in my emotions. And then my husband did say something that, you know, I'm not sure what's going on with you, but something is not right here. And, you know, I had been in and out of college for 10 years. So that's kind of how my disease manifested. I was incapable of finishing things of importance. I would just really, when things got hard, instead of buckle down and do it, I just quit and moved on to something else. So that's how it manifested. And then when my mother started to point out and all of these things, I'm very grateful that I decided that, you know what, I think it is the alcohol. And, you know, I know when I told my husband I'm quitting drinking, he was kind of, I don't think he was all that thrilled, to be honest. I think he kind of felt like it was a bait and switch.
Yeah.
Like, what happened to my drinking buddy?
That's
you
right.
know?
What happened to my drinking buddy? Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, because we were going to dinner and, you know, parties and whatnot that you do when you're young in your 20s and you're single and hanging in the bars and all that. And I kind of put a kibosh on it. I'm like, this is no longer, I just don't want any part of it anymore. And he said, well, I don't think you're an alcoholic. And I said, well, it doesn't matter what you think. It matters what I think. Mm-hmm. And I just know in my heart that my life is going to be a lot better without alcohol.
I love that.
And I was very resolute. I was very resolute. And that's what I did. And like I said, I've been sober 30 years by the grace of God.
Yes, ma'am. That's amazing. I really love the idea that of raising the bottom, like you're saying, where it's more associated, instead of being something where it's like my bottom is getting a DUI or losing my family or something terrible happening, having it be more of an emotional sort of feeling that you have where you feel like you're out of control and you're using it to check out. I love that.
Well, and I wanted people, and that's why I put the stories that I put, like I said, are people, mostly women. There are a few men in there, and I've had men that have been, even though it is geared more toward women, I've had a lot of men that have been. One guy in France actually tweeted me, and he said, Lisa, I loved it. He felt like it was a refreshed big book. And I've had other women say, it feels like a big book for women. So that is a high compliment for anyone who's familiar with the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I'm very proud that it is touching people and that, yes, I want to show that we do not have to hit these horrible bottoms, like you just said, and lose your family and just destroy your kids. I mean, the heartache, because I do work with people, and I'm still in recovery, and so I'm rubbing elbows daily with people that did wait till their lives were a hot mess. And it's devastating in many cases to see a grown man just sob because his grown children want nothing to do with him. And it may take years to mend those relationships, or the moms that feel this tremendous guilt, even though maybe they're getting sober and their kids are teenagers or middle school, but they realize how much they miss. They miss the toddler years. They miss this because they were not present. Like I was saying earlier, you know, just a little while ago, when you're not present, you don't realize how much you miss until you sober up and start becoming present and you get some clarity in your life. And it's just heartbreaking for them. I know there was one of the moms in the book who is also a physician, and she said when she came back from rehab, her 15-year-old daughter was balled up on the couch, bawling her eyes out over some boyfriend or whatever. And she said, I felt so detached and removed. I didn't know how to comfort my daughter, and I didn't really even know she had had a boyfriend.
Wow.
So that's what I'm saying. It's like, you know, parents think, oh, I'm a great mom because I show up at their soccer game, but I'm standing there on the sideline with a travel mug of wine. So actually, no, that's pretty crappy. And just the whole drinking culture of why is everyone pushing this booze? I mean, there was a friend of mine sent me, because they all know I'm all about all this stuff, and sent me a picture of a baby onesie, you know, the little onesies that little infants and toddlers might wear. And on it, it said something to the effect of, my mom is so much happier now that she can drink.
Wow.
Again, or my mom is so much more fun. Now, like, wow, why do we think this is funny? It's just, it's pitiful, really. I mean, you have a baby and your mother's drinking and, you know, raising sons. I was so grateful I was sober because there were times we had to rush to the emergency room. There were things that happened. I was never driving drunk, thank God. You talk to moms who are getting sober and they're so ashamed because they were driving drunk with kids, and, you know, it's just sad.
Right. The culture really does it nurtures the type of drinking that you're talking about. Wine
well,
culture.
And it does, and I just always say, like, why? Mm. Why?
Well,
I don't think anybody
question.
Ever asked, like, yeah. Why are we pushing it like this?
It's
right?
Interesting. Yeah,
I mean,
no, 100%. Yeah, I was kind of brainstorming here, trying to figure out why. Well, why do you think it is?
I think I think there's a lot of reasons. I think the alcohol companies spend $2 billion a year. In fact, they did last year, okay, in advertising. So just look at any TV show, movie, HGTV, it's all about the booze. I'm sure big alcohol is paying HGTV because they always zero in on people making these big financial decisions to buy a house with wine. It's crazy. It just doesn't make any sense. So I think there's that. I think there are just a lot of people that, you know, they say we quit growing when you pick up a drink. Okay, so if you start drinking when you're 15 years old in high school, and you never really slow down, and now you're 25, 30, 45. Emotionally, in many ways, you're still 15.
That's right.
So this explains why the peer pressure to drink. I was talking to a woman yesterday, and who just, she's not an alcoholic. She just doesn't like the taste of alcohol, and she just doesn't drink. And she said she has been badgered so many times with other adults, you know, questioning her, why aren't you drinking? Oh, are you alcoholic? Well, can't you just have one? Or why don't you want to just? And she said she just felt so uncomfortable. She didn't know how to handle it. Mm. And I told her, I said, you know, the people that are questioning that and are pressuring other adults to drink who just choose not to for any number of reasons, those are usually the people that have an alcohol problem.
I would agree with
and
that.
In my experience, those are the only people that ever really pressured me or gave me a hard time. And I told this woman, I said, you know, put it back in their lap and ask them, why does it bother them so much that you're not drinking?
That's actually
really good advice. And I think, you know, there's just a lot of really emotionally immature people that they cannot cope with life. They cannot cope with their children, their jobs, et cetera. And alcohol has become their go-to solution. And so they want other people to drink with them because it's almost like co-signing on their BS so that we can feel okay about it. And I can tell you, when I was in my disease, that's exactly what I did. I gravitated to the people who drank like me. And then when I was uncomfortable with my drinking and I would survey the crowd and sometimes even the bar and say, do you think I'm drinking too much? Well, they'd all say, heck no, because they're sitting there drinking with me.
That's right.
So this is just some of the mind twist that we do. So I can relate to it. I'm not shaming these people.
Totally.
I'm just saying, you know, let's just call it for what it is. If you have to badger other people and insist they drink with you, you probably have a problem with alcohol. If you're a mom and you go on play dates and you think wine is the cool thing, you probably all have alcohol problems. Because in a sane world, how do you justify alcohol in toddlers and babies? I mean, how does anybody justify that? To drive after you've been drinking with your precious cargo, to role model drinking behavior from the time they're toddlers and babies. Mm. And then these are the same parents when the kids are in middle school and they start drinking and these kids are slitting their wrist and they're unhappy. Like, really? So it goes back to the parenting, and we need to start saying, parents, wake up. If this is all you're going to role model, don't be surprised. You know, I was on another radio show and the host said she was so uncomfortable. She lives up in the northeast part of the country around D.C. And she said that her and her husband went to a brewery and she was stunned at how many toddlers were running around and how many baby carriages there were. Mm. So this is new to this generation. Like, they've lowered the bar and feel entitled to drink no matter what, whenever they want.
I think,
and it's sad.
Yeah, it's very sad. It's very sad. And I love how straight to the point you are. It's just like, how do you justify toddlers and alcohol at the same time? It doesn't, I guess, and like you said, not shaming or anything like that, but really just taking an honest look at it, right?
Right. I mean, you know, it's hard to like, I would, that could have been me. That probably would have been me. So yeah, I'm not shaming anyone. This disease is so, it's a disease of perception. So we have a distorted perception of reality. When we are in that drinking picture, we can justify the most unjustifiable thing, like we're just talking. So this is part of the disease, and this is why so many awful things happen around alcohol, because people, you're not thinking clearly, you know, to just look at the biology of it. It's addiction resides in the brain, in the amygdala part of the brain. And so when we drink alcohol or take drugs or anything, illegal drugs like heroin or, you know, things that work on the dopamine receptors that our brain wants more of, but it also, alcohol in particular, shuts down the prefrontal cortex. And so this is the part of our brain that is our computer. It is our rational brain. And this explains why, okay, think about it. If you have a teenager, nothing more dangerous than a drunk teenager, because their brains aren't fully matured until they're about 25 anyway. Right. And so now you're going to take this immature brain that does stupid things just because they're 15, and now you're going to add alcohol on it. Oh, it's so dangerous, so dangerous. So there's that. But it's even with adults the same thing. And so it explains why a lot of bad things happen. I mean, most affairs happen when alcohol is almost always part of the mix. You know, the car accidents, the domestic violence, all of these bad things happen too often because of alcohol. And people do things when they are drinking or under the influence that they would never do when they're sober. And so knowing all of this, like, why do we glorify it? Why does social media glorify it? Why do women and men and everybody glorify it? And other than, you know, there's big alcohol is making an awful lot of money off of people's misery. Because if you look at the data, alcohol is still the most widely abused drug. Last year, 72,000 people died from the opioid epidemic.
Right.
However, 88,000 people died from alcohol.
Wow.
So, you know, when I was working in the emergency room, there people are dying daily, but nobody wants to attribute it to alcohol. So somebody will die with cirrhosis of the liver and they'll say, oh, they had liver disease.
Right.
Or someone will die from, let's say, diabetes. But really, it's because they've been drinking heavily and their diabetes went unchecked and they ended up in a diabetic coma, or their glucose dropped so low that they went into a coma. I mean, any number of that. There is renal disease from just drinking so much alcohol and getting like cardiac disease and unchecked hypertension that ends up in the renal disease. But these people won't stop drinking.
Right.
So their blood pressure medicine is really not as effective as it would be. So these things are killing people, but nobody will directly attribute it to alcohol. It's always kind of, you know, oh, that's an afterthought, when really it's the primary cause.
Right, right. I can actually, as you're saying all of this, I can actually think of different people in my life for each kind of situation that you talked about there. I can actually visualize different people who have probably fallen into the category that you're talking about here, that have, you know, renal failure or cirrhosis of the liver or diabetes, or and I can even
right.
I can even visualize the people that I'm associated with on social media who glorify drinking with toddlers. I can actually see it. And that was actually, I know we have to take a break in a second, but I did want to ask you before I forget, what if we were to, because it's directed at the book, Raising the Bottom, is directed or written from, it's kind of focused more on women than men. And if we were talking to, say, my friends who may, if they were to take an honest look, be like, well, maybe I could benefit from, you know, putting the wine away for a little while. What sort of encouragement would you give maybe younger mothers who have toddlers and are wanting to be more present with their children and avoid, you know, future problems?
Well, yeah, I would, number one, tell them, and like even your male friends, tell them to read the book, because like I said, it gives you a very different perspective than what you see on the 6 o'clock news. And here's the thing, if you're someone who's drinking and you're starting to have any concern whatsoever, heed your gut, you know, that small voice, and encourage. I tell women, why are you afraid to stand up to your friends? I mean, it should start there. Like, because I have talked to women that said they're just kind of going along with it because they're afraid to lose their friend group. And I say, well, my goodness, I mean, are these really good friends then? If you can't stand up and say, hey, guys, how does this make sense? You know, if we want to have a girls' night out, have a girls' night out. Go Uber so nobody's driving, and do what you want to do and then, you know, get a babysitter for the children. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that, but if it bleeds into your daily life and you feel like you can't really parent daily without having alcohol, you're already in the danger zone. I mean, that's not normal, but we have normalized it. So I would just encourage them. I mean, I say the one ingredient that is life-changing is honesty. And that is the only reason why I got sober when I got sober, is I decided to get gut level honest with myself. And I realized that alcohol was playing too central a role in my life. I did not drink every day, but I was heading that way, you know, and I would tell them, is there a progression? So if you were only drinking once a week and now you're drinking three or four times a week, you're consumption has already progressed. And so that is another very early warning sign of getting into trouble, is if you notice a progression. If you really go out and you used to drink one drink, but now you have three or four, there's your progression. So pay attention to it instead of justify it. And if you can be honest, you know, there's a lot of information all over social media. There's books, there's tapes, there's podcasts. You know, I would encourage someone, if you're questioning your drinking at all, start exploring and start listening and relating to others like myself who have quit very early. And I have no regrets. I mean, nobody has ever regretted stopping drinking, but many, many people regret not stopping.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you so much for that. I think that's probably very, very helpful for some of our listeners out there. We're going to take a short break, 90-second break, and for a commercial, and we'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Marty Cove. You might remember me from my film roles such as The Sensei in the Karate Kid films and a variety of others. I've done over 100 films and countless stunts in my career, and I've always given 100% physically. As fun as it was, I've had to have multiple surgeries from doing some of my own stunts. With the damage done to my body over time, I needed to find relief from this chronic pain. My passion for health and fitness drove me to find a natural way to combat body and muscle pain without taking medication every day. Teaming up with doctors, detectives, and a compounding pharmacist, we created Marty's Cobra Cove Ultra Strength Pain Relief Cream. Our CBD cream is whole plant extracted and made with high-quality amino acids and essential oils that can improve the strength and the absorption. Other CBD's products, well, they aren't like ours. It's the only thing that has been strong enough to knock out my pain. And I'm not the only one. Thousands of other people have benefited from the healing attributes of these products worldwide. So check out our website at www.martyscobracove.com. It's legal, it's safe, and it's 100% effective. So show your pain no mercy.
And we're back. Thank you for that, Mr. Martin Cove. We appreciate the commercial. Are you there, Lisa? You're still there, right?
Yes, I am.
Okay, very good. So we have actually a couple listener questions. I wanted to make sure I got to these so we can get these people some advice and some help, your perspective. So the first listener question is from Savannah in California. She says, my sister is a high-functioning alcoholic who has always described herself as an occasional social drinker. A few weeks ago, she received her first DUI, which has shaken up the entire family, who were in denial to the problem. I loved that your book is specifically written for women, and I would like your advice on how I can present her with a copy so I don't want to come across as the preachy older sister.
Okay, yeah, it is a fine line, right? You know, Christmas is coming. You can say something about hey, friends, I heard about this book. My friend loved it. I thought you might like it too. Or you could read it and then just say, it's just interesting. Or you could say, now that she's had a DUI, you could address it full on and just say, you know, I love you. I care about you. And if there's a problem here, it's only going to get worse. You can stop your consequences now. And maybe this will help you because there's so many other women's stories in there. So, and my hope, and I was just talking to a woman the other day, and she said she was able to relate to so many of the stories, but some hit home more closely than others. So, I mean, at some point we do have to stop dancing around the elephant in the room and let them know that alcoholism is nothing to be ashamed of. There is help, and we have to make decisions. How low do you want to go? I mean, she probably has a lot to be grateful for, that if she didn't kill herself or anybody else. So there's really two approaches. You could do a very subtle, you know, heard about this book and put it in her Christmas stocking, or you could just hand it to her and say, I hope this, you know, maybe this will give you some insight of why you do what you do. And if you feel confused about it or unsure of where your drinking falls, those are just two approaches. You know, people are very defensive, but sometimes it's best when they are at their lower point is a good time to approach them. Because that denial, you can't deny a DUI. I mean, you could blame that on a million other things, but you know, the breathalyzer, whatever, the blood test doesn't lie. So you can try either way, whichever would fit your sister's personality better is what I would tell her.
Very good. Yeah, I like the idea of kind of like putting it in the stocking, you know, or like, so if I wonder if it's, I was just kind of thinking to myself, I wonder which one would be more effective. Because sometimes if you kind of like hit somebody with like, this is what you need to do kind of thing, there could be like some resentment that they could get and push back. Right.
Right. Right. Well, it kind of depends where they are. And that's hard to say. You know what I'm saying? Like, is she at a point in her journey where she is wanting some help and just doesn't know where to look and doesn't know how to really verbalize that? Or is she still at a very point in her journey where I don't want to hear anything? So, I mean, the sister would probably know her sister better to know where she falls in that continuum.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Great. So we have another question from Bev in Lincoln, Nebraska. She says, as I was reading the summary of your book, it hit me that my friends and I can talk about almost anything except this topic. There are six of us in our mid-40s that went to high school together. We still live in the same town and have stayed close all of these years. Going out for drinks is what we do socially, and maybe half of the group actually do show signs of alcohol or marijuana overuse. Perhaps your book is a good way to open a dialogue on the subject. And again, that's from Bev. So doesn't,
yeah, I mean, that was my hope, is that, you know, book clubs, and some are afraid to read it. And that right there tells you again, everything you need to know about your relationship with alcohol, if a book like that scares you. But I think it could be an excellent way to open dialogue. Because here's the thing is, so many women, and like, they're in their 40s. And so this is the age where it starts coming out, with marriages start imploding. Children are really getting disgusted. Or the kids are already into their own addiction, or the breast cancers, the pancreatic cancer, these horrible, you know, alcohol is a class one carcinogen. So it is in the same category as asbestos. So a great way to approach a group of women in their 40s is from a health perspective. Is like, hey, you know, a lot of people don't understand that alcohol is a class one carcinogen. So that's saying the data is there. It absolutely 100% causes cancer. So we wouldn't drink asbestos. So why are we, you know, filling ourselves with all this alcohol? And so you can approach it from a health, even saying, why don't we get healthy as a group? And if you guys go out drinking, if you can't limit it to one or two cocktails, then that right there maybe could help somebody decide if they might have a drinking problem, because it will only get worse. And then what happens is so many women and men, I've seen it in both sexes, then they end up turning to antidepressants and all of this kind of thing. And I say, you know, as a nurse working in the psych ward, it just blows my mind. And I think it's so wrong that these physicians prescribe these antidepressants without ever talking to the people about their drinking, because alcohol is a depressant. So if you're going to, if you're suffering from depression, the first thing you should do is quit drinking. And if that thought horrifies you, there's your answer. Alcohol is your problem. So that's the way, but medicine will never approach it that way because they get a lot of customers on these antidepressants. I mean, antidepressant use is up 65%. So are we all of a sudden less able to handle life? I don't think so. I think it's just, you know, the commercials and all that have everybody believing this is the solution. But they don't tell you what these drugs do, long-term effects on your mind, on your body, on your liver, on your kidneys, because every pill we take is going to be filtered through either your liver or your kidneys. Right. So these are things that I don't know that people really think about or understand or really care to think about, but maybe for them, approach it from a wellness standpoint that, hey, we're in our mid-40s. This is a time we want to be healthy so that we can be grandparents or live, you know, I don't see any point in living into your, well into your 80s if your mind is gone or if you're not active and can't get up off the couch or the chair. So that's another option of how to approach it. And it could be actually kind of fun to collectively together get on kind of a health boost and minimize your drinking and come up with some fun mocktails and, you know, have fun with it instead of making like, oh, God, you know. And maybe the ones that if they can't get on board with that, that's a way for their drinking problem to kind of shine a light on it in a very subtle way. Where they may start to have their own concerns.
I think that that's a really, really great way to kind of look at it. Is like, why don't we all start having fun together and maybe do some new activities together? And like you're saying, if there's pushback on that, then you might kind of want to look at that, right?
Right. Exactly.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Well, let's see. This is so. I thought so many things as you've been talking today. It's brought up so much for me. I've literally thought about probably 10 different people as you've been talking today. That these different things fit for these people that are just in my life. Just associations that I have. So I can only imagine for the listeners out there how helpful this is for them.
Well, I hope so, because, you know, it is heartbreaking to see people live half-lived lives and this whole stigma of like the drinking, you know, like we're out there pushing this false narrative that drinking is fun and blah, blah, blah. And every alcoholic, your first thought is, I'll never have any fun anymore and life will be boring. This is what we think. But this is another like big lie that society tells itself. Like, let's really break it down. When if your life looks something like this, go to work, come home, start drinking, or on the weekends, all we're going to do is go to bars or go to restaurants and we're going to eat, we're going to drink. So that's a pretty narrow world, you know, if you really want to get honest about it. You're totally not doing anything all that fun. You're sitting around drinking. So when I got sober is when I ended up going back to school twice. So I finished my English degree, went to nursing school. Then I started writing books. I garden, I cook, I ski. I just do all sorts of things. I take riding trips. I'm a horse nut, and I don't have horses in my adult life. So I go out west, and I ride horses, and I do all these things that I used to sit on the bar stool talking about doing. Right. And I never really did because I was just telling you all how I was going to do it. But now I do the things that I talk about doing. And then, you know, with my book and my blog and whatnot, it's become a vocation because I have a deep, deep heart and love for the children and for these mothers that are thinking they're happy and fulfilled when really they're living these lives of quiet desperation. And it doesn't have to be like that. And for too many people, what is causing their quiet desperation is the alcohol. And you just need a few brave friends to say, hey, let's do something different to maybe so that people who do have drinking problems, like I just said earlier, it kind of shines a light on it. But when we can just blend in and all just drink and go home and drink and the weekends are all about drinking, life ends up being over before you know it and you really haven't found your gift or used your talents. I mean, there's a lot of lost brilliance due to people sitting around drinking instead of doing.
Absolutely. I often think it and say it. I think a lot of it is, you know, you're not living up to your highest potential, right? And so,
right, exactly.
You gotta medicate if you're not living up to your highest potential.
Right.
So lovely. I thought I wanted to ask one more question for people who may. The hope is that you can catch it before it gets to a more severe sort of state if you've been drinking a lot. But if you have been, would you suggest, because I know you've worked in hospitals and everything, and that you've mentioned earlier that there are not a lot of doctors and that are really well-versed in alcoholism. So what would you suggest, should a person who maybe wants to quit drinking, is it something that they should do on their own, or should they go to see a doctor, or how does that work?
Well, okay, so alcohol withdrawal can kill someone. Like, people withdrawing from opioids, you're not going to die from it. You're going to be sick, but you're not going to die from it. So it really depends on how much are you drinking. If you're someone who is drinking a fifth a day, or if you're someone who is drinking so much that when you don't have a drink, you are shaking, sweating, your heart, you feel your heart palpitating. If this is what happens to you after you don't drink for maybe, you know, if you're someone who your hands are shaking badly by the end of the day, you might need to, I would suggest, if someone is serious about quitting drinking, you are going to have to get a doctor involved so that you don't go into alcohol withdrawal. And any physician, if you're honest with them, should know how to handle that. Believe me, though, some still don't. It's just kind of mind-blowing, or they'll minimize it and say, oh, you don't drink too much. I've had women tell me their doctors have told them, no, you're too young and pretty. You don't have a drinking problem. These kinds of things, it's outrageous. But so you have to be honest about how much are you drinking. Are you having withdrawal symptoms? And if you are, you should go see a doctor. Or if you really, truly want to quit drinking, you should start looking for a rehab and call them and tell them, I need help and I want to quit drinking and I'm starting to have withdrawal. And they will send them to the hospital to detox. A lot of hospitals, though, don't have detox units anymore. But some physician, even if you go to an emergency room, they can give you something to calm the shaking while you're working on the plan to get into rehab. That's one. Or if you were someone like myself, I never went to rehab. I ended up going to 12-step meetings, and that worked for me. I just knew I was having, in trouble. I remember calling my mom. I went home to her house for about 10 days, And then I came back to where I live and I just started going to meetings. Mm. So I quit though at a place where I was having no physical symptoms whatsoever. So that is also an option for people if you are able to, or you can, you know, you check out. I mean, there's all sorts of, there's smart recovery, which is less God. There is celebrate recovery, which is more God. There's Alcoholics Anonymous, which is a spiritual program. But all three of them use the 12 steps. I think the 12 steps are just amazing. So there's that. I wouldn't recommend just doing it alone because most people fail. You need, you know, in order to quit drinking, you have to address these four issues: bio, psycho, social, biopsychosocial, and spiritual. So there's the four aspects. So just to put the drink down, that's not going to work because you do need a community of people. Nobody would stay sober if it wasn't better and more fun, right? I mean, why would I stay sober 30 years if it wasn't more fun? Well, I got into a community of recovering people, and I've met some incredible people, men and women, that are doing amazing things with their lives, some very successful people. So all this, you know, the stigma just falls away when you realize, like, everything you thought about people in recovery is not true. And there's just a lot of amazing people out there. So you need to have a community. You need to find activities where you can be with sober people and have fun. And, you know, they have sober travel now. They have sober this, sober that. So there's really no better time. We're in a great time to get sober because of the vast amount of, like I was saying earlier, podcasts and information, Facebook pages, and all of this stuff. I mean, look me up on Facebook. I have a sober group for women, and I have my author page. But, you know, it's, you just have to start exploring. And that honesty piece, are you someone who needs medical intervention? Okay, get it. If you need rehab, some people cannot quit. They need that rehab. I have worked with women that they are just too far gone, and just going to meetings is not going to work for them. They've needed to go to rehab. They need that 28 days to get their mind a little bit clearer, to be in a safe environment where there is no way that they have access to the alcohol. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I want to make one more point. Just because you go to rehab for 28 days really means nothing. Recovery begins when you walk out the door, because that, being a lot of people don't understand this and they think, oh, you went to rehab, you should be cured. No, that just gives you a safe place to dry out.
That's right.
And you learn, you start learning a little bit about the disease. I think a good rehab, they do a great job of explaining the disease and what's going on and telling you about, you know, you can have pause, post-acute withdrawal for months after you quit drinking. It takes a long time for the brain to desaturate. And for, especially women, we have a lot more fat cells. So this alcohol and all of this poison is in your body for a lot longer, and it just takes time. So those are some options where people could try.
Lisa, thank you so much for your time today. It's been such a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you, Seth.
Yes, thank you so much for coming on the show today, and we appreciate all of your sage advice.
Well, I appreciate you having me. It's a lot of fun. Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. So be sure to join us next. Put us on your calendar and tune in next Monday when we'll be joined with Christy Hugsted to discuss her new book, Beneath the Surface, A Teen's Guide to Reaching Out When You or Your Friend is in Crisis. And please visit our archives of past interviews at AnswersForTheFamily.com, or subscribe to our show through iTunes, Stitcher, YouTube, or our latest platform, iHeartRadio. If you like what you hear, please leave a review. It will help us reach more people and will be greatly appreciated. And the next time you're on Facebook or Twitter, please remember to stop by our page and check out some of our latest posts. If you like them, please like us and spread the word. Thank you so much for having me, Seth Hall, filling in for Alan Cardoza.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.